and yet all are united.
What has the Father done?
Well,
he is completing his prison break. First, he escapes from the totality of infinity by moving the yolk out away from the egg, and by reunifying the yolk with the white through the universal absolute. Now, he is escaping from diffusion throughout the whole of the yolk. First, by separating himself from the absolute personality, which is his Son, and then by uniting himself with the Son in the trinitization of the conjoint creator. And now we have the organization of undivided deity incorporated, which is the paradise trinity, which fills the yoke. And now the Father can sustain a relationship to not only the totality of infinity, but also the wholeness of deity. He has completed his escape. He has produced elbow room and liberty of action. And now, instead of calling the yoke the qualified absolute, let's call it by its more conventional name, the deity absolute. This is the derivation, as I visualize it, of the deity absolute. As it says, by the technique of trinitization, the Father divests himself of that unqualified spirit personality which is the Son. But in so doing, he constitutes himself the Father of this very Son, and thereby possesses himself of unlimited capacity to become the divine Father of all subsequently created, eventuated, or other personalized types of intelligent will creatures. We have now a space stage set and a divinity stage set for everything that's happened since. As the author of Paper 10 says, we believe that the Trinity is an absolute inevitability. We just don't see how the darn thing could happen unless you have a Trinity. How else can the Father achieve liberty at the same time retaining primacy? As the Paradise Trinity, deity still fills the wholeness of deified reality, whether it be on one or another level of this firehouse, and on the top level, the Paradise Trinity activates the deity absolute, which through the universal absolute produces repercussions in the unqualified absolute. I think we should take note of the fact that Trinity formation is associated with the formation of what I would like to suggest we think of as a nuclear universe. Havona is not an end in and of itself, is it? Havona is a nucleus, is it not? It is a center universe designed to work in connection with outlying universes. The seven superuniverses are cytoplasmic universes in relation to nuclear Havona. Let me give you the definition of nucleus and cytoplasm because we're going to use it. Defined as an organ present in the protoplasm of most plant and animal cells and regarded as an essential agent in their constructive metabolism, growth, and reproduction, and in the hereditary transmission of character. And stands in contrast to cytoplasm, which is defined as the protoplasm of the cell exclusive of the nucleus. In an egg, the yellow portion would be the nucleus and the white would be the cytoplasm. Third paradise is a nucleus. I regard Havona as the true nucleus of the grand universe. We're thinking of an egg in another sense now, aren't we? The grand universe is defined as the seven superuniverses as dependent on Havona. This nucleus was formed in conjunction with a trinitization act and the formation of the Paradise Trinity. And I think as we study the development of these levels, we're going to see this same theme repeat itself. That's why I'm belaboring a little bit the concept of nuclear universes and cytoplasmic universes. Let's go back now and consider what we've covered. Deity is still static. The unity of all deity is still real. But now potentials have appeared. Deity is not just self-contained and self-existent. Deity has expressed will, has expressed purpose. Besides that, deity has now personalized itself. We don't just have a lonesome deity yearning for companionship on paradise. We have an infinite society existing on paradise. As the papers say, three persons are a minimum social group, and this is the least of all the reasons which indicate that the Trinity is necessary. Mm-hmm. God enjoys social intercourse with two equal beings. In a certain sense, yes. Functioning personality. However, if any one of us were shipwrecked alone on an island, we would not lose our personalities. We just couldn't express them socially. But I think social intercourse is essential to the avoidance of lonesomeness. And I think the Trinity concept is essential to the maintenance of the personal concept of God once you get away from the anthropomorphic level. The papers make that point very clear. There's a great danger in Unitarianism when you start to think. Allah is safe. As long as you're a fundamentalist Mohammedan, you're okay, because Allah is a very anthropomorphic God. Hence, you conceive of him as a personality. Paragraph 1, 2, 3, and 4. The paper, this is the growth of Trinity concept, the paper points out that if you have a solitary deity Incidentally, check also Rodin's challenging of God's personality. This bothered Rodin, too. If you have God all alone, how can he be personal? Who knows him as a person? First, Nathaniel's argument was, Jesus knows him as a person, can communicate with him as a person, and we can communicate with Jesus. But if you have God alone, if you've got Unitarianism, Unitarian monotheism, then as you begin to philosophize your religion, and as you de-anthropomorphize, dehumanize the God concept, you stand in danger of winding up not with God, but with an absolute, an impersonal focus of universal law. And damn it, you can't worship an absolute. You can't have much feeling about an absolute. But in Trinitarian monotheism, you never run this risk. When you de-anthropomorphize God, or depersonalize God, then you deal with something like the Paradise Trinity, and you don't, well, here. When you depersonalize deity, consider the deity absolute. Here's the comment of a universal censor. We know the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit as persons, but I do not personally know the deity absolute. I love and worship God the Father. I respect and honor the deity absolute. When you depersonalize God, you devitalize religion. You end up with a code of ethics, a philosophy, a metaphysics, a cosmology. You can have a beautiful Cadillac, but brother, you ain't got no spark plugs in the engine. Classic example of the difference. Contrast, I don't like Paul's letters very well, but I think Paul was a great guy, you know, he tried. Contrast Paul's enthusiasm with the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, which is the height of Stoic philosophy. Marcus went heavily and regretfully to the wars in Bohemia, and Paul was an enthusiastic warrior who, near the end of his years, could write, I fought a good fight. I've kept the faith. That's the difference between philosophy and religion. It doesn't have so much to do with morals, virtue, and ethics, but it has to do with, listen, the Urantia Papers present, I think, the most sane religion that's ever been offered the human race. If you want the calories of temporal success, don't look for it in the Urantia Papers or in religion. These temporal calories by which you grow temporally fat, you define fat in any way you want to, you get by temporal effort. As Rodin well said, if you want to be materially rewarded, then you have got to pitch your economic tent alongside the stream where wealth flows. And you can bestow a wonderful life up in the highlands and be wholly unrewarded. But what would calories taste like without condiments? These papers present religion not as changing the caloric content of temporal life, but as providing the salt wherewith life achieves an entirely different flavor. Religion is not calories in the temporal sense, but religion changes the taste of the calories of temporal living. Does this make sense to you? I think you enjoy eating each day much more if you have the salt and pepper of a religious attitude and a cosmic philosophy. Damn it all, if you know that this life is kindergarten, you look at it so differently, don't you? It doesn't affect your bank balance. I mean, this you get by, just like you always get money. You know, you work for it. Use your brains and ingenuity. But you can have so much more fun in the process. Paulina boiled me 2 very nice 5-minute eggs this morning. I could have eaten them without salt and pepper, but they were a lot more fun with the salt and the pepper. And that to me is what these papers add to life. Not material prosperity. B.M. Salyer and I have a lot of fun locking horns on this point. He's still got a lot of the old Egyptian notion that your bank balance and your spiritual and moral virtue have a one-in-one relationship. I don't believe that. But it seems to work for him. Of course, Charlie Rawson, you all remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Charlie always believed that you don't have to worry about money, that the Lord will provide. And so help me, Hannah, it worked for Charlie.
The papers don't express that.
No, it just worked for Charlie, that's all. Charlie would be stony broke and want to take Ann out to dinner, and sure enough, someone had come along to get married and slip Charlie $20. It worked for Charlie.
It was good psychology.
Yeah, it don't work for me, though. Right.
They show the opposite. If you want money,
that's philosophy. Very, very much. Intensely practical. Intensely practical. Golly, it works. I was talking to my dad, and he's a typical MD, you know. And he was discussing, he said, son, he said, what experience do you have with accounts receivable? Oh, I'd say the slowest of them are paid in 40 days. And he just shook his head ruefully. He said, well, he said, you work for corporations and I work for people. I said, sure. And corporations are a lot better paid. You know? You see, they pay me before taxes and the poor pop gets paid after taxes and nobody has any money after taxes. We've done. We've gone through the static, the potential, the associative, and the creative stages of total deity function. Have these stages been completed? I would submit, no. I don't know about static and potential. Maybe they have been. But the associations of deity haven't been completed. The existential associations of deity have been completed. They were completed with the formation of the Paradise Trinity. But there are other associations possible, associations between existential deity and experiential deity. Creation. The initial creative act is expressed in Havona. You say, well, now wait a minute, how about paradise? I just don't think of paradise as being an act of creation. It's pre-created. I think of creation as being inaugurated by the infinite spirit. And by virtue of this creative act, the infinite spirit comes into being. And that creative act is expressed in the central universe. The God of action functions, the dead vaults of space are astir. Is creation finished? No. From a qualitative standpoint, it's been perfectly expressed. But obviously, from a quantitative standpoint, it's only been inaugurated. The 7 super universes have yet to appear, outer space has yet to appear, and what lies beyond that has yet to appear. Here's another principle. Perfection of quality can achieve expression in the absence of infinity of quantity. Let's analyze this. When the Father and Son conceptualized Havoma, and when the conjoint creator produced it, did they hold back in any way in terms of quality of expression? The answer is no. Havoma is perfect. And if you inventory what's in Havoma, you can realize how tremendous is the quality of perfection in Havoma. The paper on the central and divine universe doesn't talk about very much that's in Havoma, because they inventory the levels of Havoma existence as material, morontial, spiritual. This makes sense, but then they go on. Absonite, ultimate, coabsolute, and absolute. The Eternal Son made 7 bestowals in Havoma. And it took the original Michael 7 bestowals to make these real to the natives of Havoma. Havoma is an unlimited expression of divinity of quality. But Havoma, want to hold this?
Sure.
I'm just like a wire recorder I turn on and off. You know, one of the things that I kind of wonder is, where the hell do all these words come from? If I had to fish for them, I couldn't do it, but they just come.
I run out in about 15 seconds, Bill.
Geez, it's happened to me. I was in a Havoma. Oh, pardon. Havoma lacks nothing in terms of the expression of divine perfection. It is an unlimited expression of divinity in quality. The Father and the Son pulled no punches, did they? This represents all that two infinite, eternal, existential deities could think of, and that a third equal deity could express in terms of quality of perfection, but not quantity. The Universal Father and the Eternal Son hadn't the least intention of doing the whole job. If they had, they would have produced a Havoma that had no boundary, an infinite Havoma. They didn't do that, did they? They limited Havoma strictly to 1 billion worlds. Here is quantitative limitation without qualitative limitation. This is a very important concept. We're going to come right back to it again at the end of this chapter in our discussions. You can have absolute quality without infinite quantity. And Havoma is the proof of it. In discussing Havoma, the papers say Havoma has enough of the absoluteness of the quality of divinity so that it can serve as a training school for paradise ascenders, no matter what level they approach paradise on. I think there's a lot about Havoma that we won't even realize when we go through. I think the whole story of Havoma is pretty much the first grade level of Havoma.
You mean what they're telling us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Dorothy, you know anything about seraphim, except through the papers and the Bible? You know any personally? Know any midwares? We got a whole division of archangels here on the planet. We got at least one company of phenaliters stationed here. One company of more of phenaliters. We've got all kinds of the seraphim, of master seraphim of planetary supervision here. We got a resident governor general of Verandadec Observer. Gosh, I bet there are all kinds of casual Melchizedeks floating around. Student visitors. Just to register this point rather thoroughly, I'll give you the number of seraphim on the planet as of the date of these papers. Let me see. Somewhere in here. At noon today, the roll call of planetary angels, guardians, and others on Urantia was 501,234,619 pairs of seraphim. Or 1,194,000 seraphim. And I am absolutely unconscious of the presence of any of these seraphim. And anything you got a billion of isn't exactly rare.
Is it your opinion that anyone on the planet at the present time is conscious of these people?
I don't think so, no. A reservist might be under at rare and unusual circumstances. We're told that sometimes at moments of death, the dying mortal dimly perceives the seraphim and immediately, of course, translates it into conventional seraphic imagery.
Yeah.
Okay, when we go through Havona, I think we're going to be just as ignorant of a lot that's going on in Havona as we are right here on this planet.
On our initial sojourn. Really.
Right.
Yeah.
And as long as we're operating on the first floor, which means as long as we know anything about phenaliters. The oldest phenaliters in existence are still operating on the first floor.
Today?
Today.
Oh.
I think Havona operates on, exists on all three floors. So, the Universal Father and the Eternal Son and their deity equal, the conjoint actor, evidently didn't want to do the whole job, did they? They wanted a perfect universe. They wanted to express themselves. And when they expressed themselves, they didn't hold back. They pulled no punches. They produced a universe which, among other things, is absolute in quality of divinity and all other things regarding perfection. But they limited it in terms of size, in terms of quantity. Are you running out too?
Go right ahead, though.
The stoles had to be translated. They were transcendental things. Yes?
Bill, if this planet were not isolated, spiritually isolated, would you conjecture that we have any more conscious of these things? We
would
have nothing to do with it. So ordained.
No, we wouldn't be conscious of it. The only time we would ever see such beings, Dorothy, would be in the Age of Light and Life, in the Marantia Temple. They would visualize to us certain of the lower orders.
Mm-hmm.
How about it? We've been over today?
Yeah.
Well, we're examining what I think is one of the basic concepts in the Urantia book. The seven levels of the function of total deity. And we started out with the static level, which means that everything is self-contained. As they say later on, infinity is filled by the infinite and is encompassed by infinitude. This is the nearest you can come to saying that you start with a homogeneous beginning. But it's really not homogeneous, it's heterogeneous. A homogeneous beginning would be the scrambled egg that we've talked about. And the papers specifically refuse to validate the homogeneity of original reality. They say there was always the possibility for self-will. And so we start not with a scrambled egg, but a fried egg. A yellow, or a nucleus, and a white, or a cytoplasm. I like that too, because the potential for growth is in the nucleus, not in the cytoplasm. It's the nucleus that initiates change. It's the cytoplasm that responds to change. And that suggests the difference between deity and non-deity. Deity is active. Non-deity is passive. Deity initiates. Non-deity responds. Or deity takes snuff and the unqualified absolute sneezes. And so we project what happens when we hit the second level of total deity function. This involves a separation from, a separation between the cytoplasm and the nucleus. The yolk moves out away from the egg, and immediately a relationship establishes between the yolk and the egg. The reactive, non-initiating, responsive cytoplasm is the unqualified absolute. The yolk is the totality of deity, which at this point we call the qualified absolute, because it's changed position. It's qualified itself, yes.
Please repeat those adjectives.
The relationship between them is a deity relationship, not a non-deity relationship. Because the universal absolute is deity. The universal absolute is not non-deity. This universal absolute, we are informed, functions on the static, the potential, and the associative levels of total deity function, but not beyond. Now, we continue to trace out the fortunes of the yolk of the egg. This qualified absolute is pervaded by volition, personality, purposiveness, by all which is expressed in the three personalizations of deity. But the Universal Father still isn't the Universal Father, is he? While he now has separated himself from that which is non-deity, he still pervades the wholeness of deity. As Acrimides said, I need somewhere to stand in order to move the world. And the Universal Father needs to stand in relationship to something in order to engage in creative action. And so he begins to separate himself from the whole of the qualified absolute, from the whole of the yolk of the egg. And he does so first by divesting himself of absolute personality.
This is
the being who becomes the Universal Father. I call him the Universal Father. It's a misnomer, but that's what we're talking about. He steps away from the absolute personality, and in so doing, makes himself father of that absolute person. And this is the origin of the eternal Son. And in becoming father of the absolute person, He creates the capacity, he establishes the capacity to become father of all persons. At the same time, he builds the absolute machine to do for him just what a machine does for a human being, to engage in repetitive acts, to function as the material governor of the material cosmos as yet unborn. And then, standing on paradise with the sun, using paradise as a power platform, he and the eternal sun jointly project an expression of creation which is unlimited as to quality, but strictly limited as to actual quantity. They project and create a perfect central universe, which is limited in space and mass, but unlimited in quality of divinity. And in so doing, they trinitize an equal being, the infinite spirit, who is the eternal expression of their united wills. And in so doing, they also bring into being the Trinity union of the three personalizations of deity. And now, the Father has completely escaped from diffusion, not only throughout the egg, but also throughout the yolk. Henceforth, it is only in conjunction with his two deity equals and as the Trinity that he will pervade all deity reality. And now the Father has liberated himself from the limitations of absoluteness. He's achieved the ability to move. You'll recall that we took inventory of the zero age, and we said, what do we have? In terms of actual existence, we have a power base, paradise, and two existential deities. And what takes place? A trinitizing act, producing a deity equal and giving expression to a nuclear universe. Why nuclear? Because it serves as the nucleus of the grand universe to be. It is the center through which hereditary characteristics are to be transmitted out into the cytoplasmic seven super universes. Are you with me? That's all we said.
Could you repeat that last one for me?
All right.
The zero age.
The zero age gives rise to the first universe age, the age of Havoma, in this way. In the zero age, we have two existential deities, Father and Son, and a power base. The Father and Son trinitize a deity equal and give expression to a perfect universe. And a trinity, the first trinity, the paradise trinity, forms concurrent with the formation of the first nuclear universe. Nuclear because it is designed to transmit characteristics, inheritance factors, and growth out into the super universes to be. And these seven super universes are as cytoplasmic universes in relation to the Havona universe, which is the nuclear universe. I hate to introduce nucleus and cytoplasm, I gotta do it, because we're gonna use it again and again this week. It's a handy concept. Each cell in your body has a nucleus, and the surrounding protein is the cytoplasm around that nucleus. And an egg is the best illustration I can think of. End of the discussion of the derivation of the potential of physical universes from paradise. That's what we've talked about all morning. Isn't that simple? Will we recap? And we've gotten down to the fourth level of the function of total deity, creative. Yes?
Bill, what does it mean by paradise is the pattern of all material reality?
There are two master patterns. The master pattern of non-deity or material reality is the Isle of Paradise. And the master pattern of all personalities is the personality of the Eternal Son. Either way, paradise and the sun are related. They are opposites. They are antipodal complements. They are antithetical complements. Positive and negative complements. One is about as much the opposite of the other as they could be. But here's something very interesting. You remember the duration of the cycle of space respiration? 2 billion years. It's a function of nether paradise. There is a creative cycle which pertains to the population of the worlds of the eternal sun. You know, the middle group of paradise satellites, and that creative cycle is also 2 billion years.
What do you mean, creative cycle?
I'm not sure what I mean, but I'll read you what the book says, and we can both guess at what it means. How about that? Mm-hmm. On page 149, in the very short section dealing with the sacred worlds of the eternal sun, the paradise philosophers maintain that each paradise cycle, about 2 billion years of Urantia time, witnesses the creation of additional reserves of these orders on the secret worlds of the eternal sun. I don't know that there's any relationship between the 2 billion year cycle of space respiration and the 2 billion year creative cycle on the worlds of the eternal sun. But I would be surprised if there weren't some connection.
What was the page number, Bill, please?
149. Deal in terms of degrees of eternity the infinite spirit and Havona are eternal. Paradise and the eternal and the second source and center are eternaler. And the first source and center is eternalist. In other words, had this transaction taken place in time, this is the sequence. There are source relationships in eternity which you can only translate into Bantu by using time sequence relationships. Are you with me? Bantu. You weren't here this morning.
No.
Right, we're discussing the problem of the revelators by drawing an analogy. How would you describe American civilization in the Bantu language?
Yeah.
And you're limited to the language. And we pointed out too, Ruth, that while English can be translated into Bantu, Yuvarsa cannot be translated into English whatsoever.
Yeah.
You have to go through 2 weeks. A good deal that's in all the papers. We may spend all day on the forward. And if you're interested enough, we may spend all tomorrow on the forward, too. Because if we can really chew this one up fine, we're not going to hit much else that's tough in the whole book. You know? The forward actually is a very easy paper if you spend enough time with it. I got mad about it once and took a week off, and I spent 100 hours on just this one paper. with an unabridged dictionary, and the papers laid out. And this is when I unified my ignorance about the foreword. I'm very sure I know exactly what the foreword means, and I'm quite sure I'm wrong in a number of places. When you come right down to it, the foreword presents just a few ideas. The foreword discusses just five topics. It discusses, number one, deity, in three sections, 1 to 3. Second, it discusses reality, what is real, again, in three sections, four, five, and six. It discusses, third, experiential deity, again in three sections, four sections, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Gosh, I can't count those Roman numerals. Fourth, it discusses the three absolutes in section 11. And fifth, the trinities in section 12. And of course, you have the acknowledgement. When you come right down to it, that isn't a whole lot of material. The catch is, it's rather complex. Deity, reality, experiential deity, which is really a subdivision of the discussion of deity, the three absolutes, which is an extension of the discussion of reality, and the trinities, which is a summation of the discussion of deity. Really, all they're talking about here is deity and reality in one form or another. Just two themes. Why would you separate reality from deity? Because all reality is not deified. One of the very great statements made in the Urantia Papers is found in paper 12 in the Universe of Universes. Quote, God is spirit, but paradise is not. Here we touch upon one of the essential differences between the metaphysics or cosmology of the Urantia Papers and many other religions. Maybe I can illustrate it best by telling you an experience I had with a Christian Scientist, wife of a professor at Emory University. I regard Christian Science as an occidentalization of Hinduism or Buddhism. I'd given a talk at their School of Journalism, and we were out for a little wingding near, what is it, Stone Mountain or someplace around there, where they serve Southern style, you know, they get a Lazy Susan with chicken and ham and hush puppies and all other kinds of lethal foods. And I started the story relating to Christian Science. And I could tell by the horrible hush that fell over the table that I was really engaged in laying a beautiful egg. So I proceeded to give birth to the egg as quickly and decently as possible and go on to other things. Well, afterwards, my host's wife, as we got back to his home for a little branch water and bourbon, told me, she said, Bill, she said, I think you're a fairly, I hope you're a tolerant person. She said, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Christian Science. Well, I said, I realized then who had created the problem, my problem. I said, sure. So we sat down and talked. She's a pretty savvy gal, and we made a very sincere effort to communicate. And I finally got it down, and I said, look, I know why we will never agree. I said, you believe in just one form of energy, and I believe in three. To her way of thinking, there is only one quality of reality. And I would describe it in our terminology as something which is about 85% mind and 15% spirit emulsified. It's mind with a touch of spirit in it. And since she believes in only one form of reality, she believes there's only one set of laws operating in the universe. And if you can get with this one set of laws, you can work everything. I believe in three forms of reality: material, mindal, and spiritual. I believe there are three sets of laws. I'm ignoring personality for the moment. And I believe that if you want to produce spiritual results, you apply one set. You want to produce a material effect, I think praying is strictly for the birds. Set up a material cause. And of course, you have the intervening zone of intellectual reality, which touches on both matter and spirit. When we get all through, she said, well, she said, I see. She said, you really couldn't pray for a material thing, could you? I said, for me, this would be blasphemy. A knowing transgression of my best comprehension of universe law. You find in Hinduism, they tend to believe in one form of energy, in just one reality. You have Brahman, and you have Maya. In other words, you either are dealing with the absolute, or you are dealing with an illusion. And this is true in most religions which touch upon pantheism. The Urantia book presents not only three forms of energy operating under three distinctly separate types of law. The Urantia book presents the concept of reality which is both deified and undeified. Not anti-deity, but non-deity. As we look at these papers, we're going to observe that there are two absolute realities which are non-deity. Paradise is not deity. Neither is the unqualified absolute. Neither are non-responsive to deity. But neither is deity. Paradise is a lot easier to comprehend than the unqualified absolute. I think the simplest definition of paradise is a machine which God built for the same reason that men build machines. In other words, a part of the control of this universe is mechanistic. And why should God be personally concerned with something which a machine can handle? We have the same reaction, we should understand that. Where you have a repetitive act of a mechanical nature, what do you want to do? We want to build a machine. It's characteristic of personality. And one of the reasons is because God himself set this pattern when he designed the absolute machine. And the material heart of the material cosmos is a material reality, not a spiritual reality. We have deified reality, we have undeified reality. And of course they interact. In a human being, I think you have the most comprehensible presentation of the interaction of three kinds of reality: matter, mind, and spirit. Not human spirit, but endowed spirit. Here we have an interassociation of the three functioning realities in the finite universes, plus a fourth, personality, which is one of the difficult concepts to get in the Urantia papers. The Urantia papers put some new twists on several words. Personality is one. Space is another. We'll spend some time talking about space, because these papers present space as a positive reality, not just a negative reality. And these papers present personality as something quite different from your character, your temperament. We even use personality as a crude synonym for sex appeal, you know, or social charm. But personality is presented in these papers as the fourth reality. Something which is not matter, not mind, and not spirit. And which differs, in a way, from matter, mind, and spirit. Because matter, mind, and spirit, while they are qualitatively different, they exist in terms of quantity. They respond to gravity. And you can measure the degree of response so that you can speak not only of material mass, but intellectual mass and spiritual mass. Personality has quality, but no quantity. There is no mass to personality. And while we're at it, let's talk a little about that. I think the most helpful way of looking at personality is to think of an abstract color. Think of yellow. You all can conceptualize yellow, can't you? But did you ever see yellow except in relation to some object? No. Now you've got a feeling for what personality is. You can conceptualize, you can conceive a personality in the abstract, but you will never see a personality except it is associated with one or more of the acting energies in time and space. These papers can talk about personality in the abstract, but personality never functions unless it is associated with a living energy system. Any more than you have ever seen yellow in the abstract. You only see a yellow vase. You see a yellow flower. You see the yellow light of the sun. But you can still think of yellow apart from these things. Does this help you in relation to personality? If you take personality away from living energy, you have something which is real, but is wholly non-functional. And I believe is non-detectable on sub-deity levels. I think God knows it's there. But I don't think we do. I think some of his deputies may know where it is, but I don't think creatures do. Personality is to a living energy system, in a way, what a color is to an object. It unifies the whole object. When it's there, it dominates. You have some subtle relationships as we get into these three energies. A spiritual being is not a personality simply by virtue of being a spiritual being. This is interesting. A spirit entity can be very real and yet be other than personal. If a spiritual being is a personality, it is because the Father has added personality to spiritual reality. And in a way, this illustrates the primacy of the Father in relation to the Son, who is the active center of spiritual reality. How does spirit relate to mind? Do you have to endow a spiritual being with mind to enable it to think? The answer is no. Spirit is minded without mind. Illustrating the primacy of the Son in relation to the conjoint creator. Spirit is antecedent to mind, but not to personality. Isn't that interesting? Is a minded being essentially spiritual? The answer is no. Any more than a spiritual being is necessarily personal. I think these are interesting relationships, illustrating the functional relationships of the three deities and their primacy in relation to each other.
Well, as we go along, could we have some examples of these?
I can't give them to you in all instances.
No, not in all instances, but just enough.
Well, let's say...
feet on the ground.
Yeah. The inhabitants, the unrevealed inhabitants of the worlds of the eternal sun are not personalities. They're created by the eternal sun. They're spiritual beings. We don't know anything about them except we know they're not personal. A thought adjuster is a spiritual reality but not a personality unless God chooses to personalize that thought adjuster. An intelligent being may not be spiritual. I don't think an associate power director is a spiritual being at all. But I'm sure an associate power director is an exquisitely intelligent being. I suspect such beings will be our instructors. When we graduate from the local universe and become first aid spirits, and instead of studying God, we study physics and astronomy and the physical constitution of the universe of universes. And that's not as paradoxical as it might seem. I think maybe if you get outside of matter, then you can really understand matter. You can look at it from an exterior perspective. Those of you who have developed at-homeness in a foreign language know how much you can appreciate English because you can think from a position exterior to the English language. And I don't mean when you stop translating now. This becomes a second language. It's just like if you leave this country, you have a wonderful basis of comparison and a new ability to appreciate what we have here and also what they have there. Well, should we launch forth? I want you to stop me as we go along. And let's see what we can get out of this. Because if we can pour a good foundation of comprehension in this forward, we'll have a feeling for the whole of the difficult parts of this book. And we'll jump from the forward all over the book. We'll get involved in, universal unity. We'll get involved in the Supreme Being papers, growth of the Trinity concept, deity and reality and what have you. And I'll try and make this fun for you because you're involved in this forward in more ways than you would believe possible. This is interesting when you see your relationship to it. I don't think we need to say much about the introduction to the forward. That's pretty clear. But when we get into deity and divinity, we got some problems. Right in the first sentence there, they discuss levels of deity. And we really can understand only one of the discussed levels of deity function, the personal. We're personalities. Hence we can deal with God as a father of personalities. This makes sense to us because the fatherhood relationship is one which we either observe or have experienced, or of both observed and experienced. Parenthood is an easy thing for reproducing creatures to comprehend. But is the first source and center the father of a thought adjuster? Oh, yeah, you can use poetic license and use the word father there. But actually, he's not, is he?
He's a part of him. A fractional part of him.
We have no word for it. What is the relationship of a source to a fragment? You can be father only to a son. God is father to a personalized adjuster. Co-father, the mortal contributors to the adjuster's character are also parental there. But what is the word you use to describe the relationship of the first source and center to a fragment of himself that is not a son? We have no word. Neither do we have a word adequate to express God's relationship to an eventuated being, where God is functioning in a superpersonal sense. What does the word superpersonal mean? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You cannot grasp it, except you know it's not personality. Not less than personality, but more than personality. But you see, the word personality is a maximum word in our experiential comprehension. We know of nothing beyond personality. We can conceive of a subpersonal being as an animal. We have experience here. But that's not analogous to the pre-personal level of the Universal Father. A thought adjuster is not an animal. Neither can we understand what a superpersonal being is, because we're working up here on the second story of Undivided Deity Incorporated. And when they say that God as a superperson eventuates beings, what does that mean? Well, they've taken an English word and put an odd twist on it. They might just as well say he gloops them. You know what I mean? That's an arbitrary word. And it would be just as meaningful. They are not created. Then how do they come into being? Who knows? It's by a different technique. Fragmentation, I can visualize as the tearing off of a piece. But eventuation is completely beyond me. I just know it's not creation. You see, we're getting into trouble as we deal with levels, and also this whole darn thing is complicated by the difference between a time reality and an eternity reality. I don't understand eternity. I just know it's not time. When they describe eternity events in these papers, they often use the present tense. And it makes just as much sense to put them in the present tense as it would the past tense. They do not say the God of action functioned in the dead vaults of space, were astir. They say the God of action functions and the dead vaults of space are astir. It's no more distortion to say that this is happening in the present moment as it would be to say that it happened at any past moment in time, because it never happened in any past moment in time. Let's see if we can get a little empathy for the problems we're encountering here. I would like each one of you to visualize this assignment. For whatever reason, you have been commissioned by some bureau in the American State Department, and it is your job to go to Africa. You can have textbooks with you, you can carry quite a lot of baggage, and it is your job to go into the still remaining darker portions of Africa, and you are going to dictate a series of presentations of the American way of life to Bantu tribesmen living in the Stone Age of culture. And interpreters have been provided, you don't know Bantu, interpreters have been provided who are fluent in Bantu and who have a complete grasp of English as well. And in the course of your discussions, you have gotten to the chapter which deals with the functioning of the New York Stock Exchange in relation to American economy. And you are thinking, how do you present the relationship between common stocks, cumulative and non-cumulative preferred, debentures, secured debentures, the relationship between these liens against the earnings of a holding company and similar obligations issued by subsidiary companies, which have a prior claim to the earnings of subsidiaries, which eventually will be funneled as dividends into the holding company, and the relationship of the income tax structure to the interest and dividends ultimately received by the bondholders and stockholders of this corporation, and the relationship of all this as it pertains to the American economy in terms of the rise and fall of the price of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange.
Their language would do it.
And so you start out, and the interpreter says, sorry, in Bantu, no word for common stock. And little by little, you begin to adjust your thinking. And the chances are that what you wind up with is a description of something very much like a state fair, where produce is brought to a given spot and bartered and exchanged. And you either describe it this way or you skip the story of the New York Stock Exchange. Look, there's a tremendous gap between the verbal concepts in primitive Bantu and mid-20th century English. But you can translate from English into Bantu. It can be done. The language of Uversa is not translatable into English under any circumstances. There is no overlap. The gap between Uversa and English is tremendously greater than the gap between English and Bantu. You have to go from Uversa to the town of Salvington, and even then you can't translate into English. But from Salvington you can go to the town of Satania, and now you can translate into English.